Okay, let's go ahead and get started here as my computer goes to sleep. Perfect timing. There we go. Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. Some familiar faces from the last couple days, but also some new faces here. So I'll just go ahead and reintroduce myself. I'm Jim Bolter. I am professor of chemistry, public health, and environmental studies at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Thrilled to be here at Holden Village to talk with you all about a topic that I'm really passionate about and happy to share with you all. So in the past couple days, right, so we had an introduction to what the nature of sustainability was, particularly when we take a global view of it. More recently, we looked at some of half of the 16 sustainable development goals, or 17, I suppose, here. We looked at 8 of them. Those focused on issues most related to society. If I get my pointer here. Poverty, hunger, health, education, gender equity, access to clean and affordable energy.
Cities,
yep, sustainable cities, and coming all the way up to here to 16 to for peace. Thank you for the assist there, folks. That's great. All right, so today we're going to really look at the other 8. We're going to start by looking at some of the more environmentally focused SDGs. And we'll actually back up. When we looked at those first 8, one of the things we had an opportunity to do is recognize that in addition to being these sort of lofty goals, end poverty, no more hunger, create a peaceful, stable society, there were much more concrete targets, right? And of those targets, we didn't look at these, but we got a sense that there are even a larger number of quantitative indicators that show us how close we are as a global society and as individual nations or region of the world, how close we are to achieving those metrics. Furthermore, we had a chance to consider how the recent 5 years or so since the SDGs were passed by the United Nations, how the obvious social upheaval of COVID and the war in Ukraine, climate change, and other things have really affected those social goals. As we look at the environmental and economic goals today, we're actually going to dive right into them. I'm going to spend much less time talking, and hopefully that will give us much more time for discussion. And so I think with that overview, are there any questions before we sort of dive right in?
I came here hoping you'd tell me how to get to heaven. I'm concerned, the earth. What happens to Earth? That's another matter.
I'm afraid you'd better talk to my wife or yourself, one of the pastors in the crowd. As the chemist, I'm afraid I'm not helpful at all, but thank you. Instead, staying hewing far from the issue of salvation, actually, I did have one other thing I wanted to do, first of all, which is I did want to show a quick... Just for those of you who haven't been here before or are new to this class, I just wanted to do a quick video, which is just for amusement more than anything else, which is a quick overview of the Sustainable Development Goals. And of course, I have to exit out of that first, don't I? There we go. Try that again. There we are.
We can be.
We must be. The first generation
to end extreme poverty.
The generation
most determined
to fight injustice
and inequalities.
The generation that saves the planet from climate change.
And this is how it will get done.
The global goals.
A 15-year plan
for everyone, everywhere.
With no one left behind.
We live in a world
where nobody
anywhere
lives in extreme poverty.
Where no one
goes hungry.
Where no one
wakes in the morning
asking if there will be food today.
We will live in a world
where no child has to die
from diseases we know how to cure.
And where proper health care
is a lifelong right for us all.
We will live in a world
where everyone goes to school.
And education gives us the knowledge
and skills
for a fulfilling life.
We will live in a world where all girls and all women have equal opportunities
to thrive and be powerful and safe.
We cannot succeed if the world is cut back.
We will live in a world
where all people can get clean water
and proper toilets
at home, at school, and at work.
We will live in a world where there's sustainable energy for everyone.
Heat, light,
and power for the whole planet.
Without destroying the planet.
We'll live in a world where economies prosper.
A new wealth
leads to decent jobs
for everyone.
And we will live in a world
where our industry,
our infrastructure,
and our
best innovations
are not just used to make money, but to make all our lives better.
We will live in a world
where prejudices and extremes of equality
are defeated.
Inside our countries
and between different countries.
Where people live in cities and communities
that are safe, progressive,
and support everyone who lives there.
Where we replace
what we consume.
Planet where we put back
what we take out of the earth.
We live in a world that is decisively rolling back
the threat of climate change.
Where we restore
and protect the life in our oceans and seas.
We restore
and protect
life on land,
the forests,
animals,
the earth itself.
With peace between and inside countries.
Where all governments are open.
An answer to us for what they do at home and abroad.
And the justice rules.
With everyone equal before the law.
Where all countries and we their people
work together
in partnerships of all kinds
to make these global goals a reality
for everyone, everywhere.
These are the United Nations global goals
for sustainable development.
Let's get to work.
Let's make it happen.
Okay, challenge accepted, right? Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to start with biosphere. We're going to look at just four of the goals to begin with here, and they are clean water and sanitation, climate action, life below water, and life on land. And we're going to do so, we're going to be looking at these four goals within the context of a little document that maybe some of you have heard of. Who's heard of the encyclical Laudato Si, published by Pope Francis in 2015. And so what I want to do, great, so about a third of you maybe, what I want to do is I want to have you, as you did last time, those of you who are here, look at some of the statistics from the 2022 Sustainable Development Goal Report and comment on those. Look at the targets for each of them. We'll break you into four groups. And then read a brief excerpt from Laudato Si. And I want you to think of the following. And those of you who were here yesterday, these will be familiar to you. So looking at the statistics here about the SDG you'll be looking at, something that surprised, distressed you, elicited a sense of loss, or maybe gave you hope. And then looking at the back of that first page, which will be the targets for the goal. For example, if we're looking at clean water and sanitation, some of the targets might be by 2030, achieve universal and equitable access to safe and affordable drinking water for all. That would be one of the targets. So choose two or three of the targets that maybe explicate a little bit what the goal, overall goal is about, because just the goal itself, clean water and sanitation, maybe isn't clear enough, right? So that's the first thing. And then from Laudato Si, I want you to just ask the following questions. And these are just brief excerpts, less than one page. How do you relate to this goal differently through Pope Francis's words than from the UN SDG Progress Report? And think about how faith leaders might speak to these issues, and in addition to subject matter experts, and the importance of that. One thing that's not on there, especially those of you who were in yesterday's class, I want you to start drawing connections between these sustainable development goals. They're not all listed for you on the screen all the time, right? But if you're saying, okay, so clean water and sanitation, what is that going to be potentially related to? And you might say, well, that might be related to SDG 3, which is about diseases. And if you don't know what the number is, you're like, oh yeah, that's probably related to healthcare, isn't it, right? And so you might be able to think about how this SDG might be related to others. Okay, so we've got a fair few of you here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to first throw on my mask. And I'm going to ask you to choose. So find, I think, if I do my math here, 20-ish, so about five. So in groups of two or three of you, take these two pages here, and I will and here, if you would, and so that's, so you're looking at SDGs 6, 11, 12, and 13, or sorry, 6, 13, 14, and 15, and over here I'm going to ask you to look at 6. So we're going to be doing double duty here. Here is 13. And if you would maybe hold down 14 and you would hold down 15. So find yourselves in groups of two or three, just so long that everyone is attached to a document. And you can look through these two documents together and we'll report back out on some of those things right there. Good. Make sure you introduce yourselves. So, while I'm quite sure that you could continue these smaller conversations on this sort of very rich, these rich texts for minutes or hours to come, I do want to expand the conversation to the big group again. So we're going to go just through these, and what I'll ask is for each group that that coalesced around a particular topic, just to volunteer again, just a reminder, right? It's basically something from each of the pages, right? The first page there of statistics, second, the back page of the targets, and the third page of the Laudato Si quotes. We're going to just share something out, and we'll start with clean water and sanitation. There was two groups that looked at that. Would either of you like to share a little bit of what you talked about that we can broaden the conversation to the whole group? Yeah. Remind me of your name.
Sulia.
Thank you, Sulia.
So I think the shocking statistic is that at current rates in 2030, 2.8 billion people lack safely managed sanitation or won't have access to a safely managed toilet, which is, at that point, probably around a third of the population.
Right.
Which would be like, if there were three of us sitting here, one of us would not have a toilet.
Right. That's a shockingly large number.
Insane.
Yeah.
And then...
So let's hold that. Let's maybe, who was the other group that I gave SDG 6 to? Who else? Yeah, did you want to share any, maybe the statistic that you noticed? Maybe it was the same one.
Well, we kind of got off on talking about if it becomes privatized, just the equity and justice. You're going to have to change systems to make that possible. And going after systems is difficult. When you do it on a macro level, you're going to have to. It won't change.
Yeah, absolutely. System change is absolutely fundamental to all of this conversation, right? It's hard work, but it's the effective way to do it. Let's go back to you. You were going to talk about some of the targets you looked at.
It's a lot of the targets are achieving equitable and universal access, and how that is that pretty much involves everything from protecting resources and that improves water quality and stuff like that.
Okay. Did this group over here talk about some of the targets in particular?
We talked about the difficulty just with climate change, for instance. You can set a target, but the whole equation is thrown off, because you might have targets set up and working toward that, and if all of a sudden you're not getting rainfall anymore,
right,
you're going to have to adjust constantly to change the situation. It needs to be flexible.
Right. Okay. So we're actually going to approach these questions here as a full group, actually. So let's continue through the SDGs a bit. Let's hear from the folks who looked at 13, climate action, and hear about some of the statistics and maybe some of the targets that you looked at. So who had climate action? Yeah, Ted.
So the statistic that struck us similarly involved a lot of people. 700 million people potentially displaced due to drought and by 2030. So that's a huge number of people that are going to need somewhere else to live in a short amount of time.
Right, and comparing that to numbers of displaced people now, right? Yeah. Well, in Ukraine, does anyone know offhand about what the number of displaced people in Ukraine was over the past year?
Over a million.
What?
Yeah. Over a million.
Over
10 million.
Yeah, 10 million, yeah?
Yeah.
So even that extraordinary incidence of displacement, we're looking at numbers that are substantially larger, right? Other group that was looking at SDG 13?
Yeah. It was hard to pick out a specific element, but I mean, from the drought and the changing environment with the floods and fires and continuing rise of the CO2, we integrated that in with, well, not to the back page with the...
Right.
We'll wait for that.
Go ahead. No, go follow that through.
Kind of looking at that as being that education still sounds to be a really important element. And part of the Pope statement, it talks about sadly, you know, there's widespread indifference. And then it goes on, our lack of response to these tragedies, you know, the brothers point to a sense of loss of responsibility. I mean, it's an incredible tragedy that, and how can one knowingly not respond? Is what we're kind of hoping that with education, we'd have a better ability to have a better response.
Great. Is there a specific target related to education? Does it say?
Yes.
Does it articulate what that target is?
No. Well, it was number 13.3, raising awareness on human institutional capacity at climate change mitigation and adaptation, impact reduction, and early warning.
Okay.
That's actually not a target.
That's not a
target. Well, the quantitative part would actually come in the indicator, I suppose, right? Which is the indicator would be the quantitative element of that. Yeah. So let's see. So Tad, your group over here, did you talk further about, were there other targets that you had talked about?
We didn't talk a whole lot about this, but we, you know, had the sense that education is, there is progress being made, at least as far as sort of general awareness. But integrating climate change measures into national policies, strategies, and planning, there's certainly a lot of action in that. Not like concrete action of doing things, but getting together, having meetings, talking about it, and to some extent integrating it into national policies. There are carbon markets in various places around the world that are, you know, trying to work on it at an economic level.
Right. So it's one thing to have the United Nations have a target of 1.5 degrees Celsius. It's another thing for individual national governments to now integrate those targets into their own policy
making. Especially if the national government is heading an empire where they need to maintain their political and economic interests all over the world.
Yes. And if that national government is GDP is deeply dependent, say, on oil production, right? Yeah. So definitely. Yeah. Let's move on to life below water. And what are some of the things that you learned about the the trajectory of the goals for Life Below Water, and what some of the targets for those might be. Yeah.
So this was extremely distressing. You said find hopeful or distressing. I don't think that's the word you used. Total distressing. Everything is going the wrong way. That was huge fact. 17 million metric tons of plastic entered the ocean in 2021. This is projected to double or triple by 2040. So going, all of these things are going the wrong way. There are 10 of the whatever they're
targets yeah.
that were listed. Some of them are already passed by 2020. Mm. Do some stuff. I said, well, that's not going to happen. But what we talked about, Doug brought up that to do that would require political will. And we're looking at each one and say, well, that would require political will. So a target that almost seems to be a prerequisite would be find some political will to actually start to turn these things around.
Yes, absolutely.
They're going all in the wrong direction.
Right.
Pretty scary.
Thank you. Yes.
To a question about how is that plastic getting into the water? Like in our ocean? Are we just dumping it in there? Is it people just like they're on the boat and like, oh, throwing it over? Or is it like
a lot of it is coming through rivers and streams and tributaries. So if you think about American, just thinking for a moment about American, you know, a lot of times we have combined storm sewers. And so anything, you know, garbage that ends up in the street oftentimes ends up in our storm sewers, then gets into our rivers and streams and then washes downstream. But honestly, a lot of that is we export a lot of our garbage, right? Especially plastic waste is exported. Sometimes we believe it's recycled. In reality, it's recycled far less than we think it is. And so it's shipped overseas. And sometimes when there's no effective market for it, that plastic can be dumped across a landscape in the developed world. One of the ways we export misery. And so a lot of the plastic waste might originate from, you know, exported plastic waste. And then you know, other parts of the world where they don't have municipal waste handling services, right? There's going to be so there's a variety of entry points, I suppose.
We were struck by that same figure, the 17 metric tons of plastic, 17 million metric tons.
Right.
I mean, that's horrible. We were wondering about cruise ships, if they're regulated, because they would be...
They're regulated, what?
Do they take care of their waste on those ships like they need to?
I know the human waste is dumped directly because they're in international waters and they can. I don't know. Jacob, do you have a sense? There's rules regulating because it's international waters that are unenforced. Is that your sense?
It's my impression that there's laws against dumping plastic and that kind of stuff. I don't know about human waste.
Yeah.
They're equipped so they can, there's holding tanks for it on these ships and they're supposed to unload it in ports. Mm-hmm. But of course they pay for that service.
Right.
Human waste is at least biodegradable.
Right. Right.
I think if you go back, you think about these massive mega cities on coastal areas or on the rivers on coastal areas and millions of people with no waste services to pick up plastic waste, it's going to end up in the ocean.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I think the solution is to do away with plastic for the most part.
Right. And we'll come back to that, so thank you for mentioning that. Yes?
Our church in Ballard, in the Seattle area, we've gone over to Ocean Shores and done what we call a beach cleanup.
Mm.
That is just boggled my mind, all the stuff that we find when we go over there and work that beach. And we're only on a short, compared to the whole beach, we're only on a small area. We just get mounds of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's an incredible problem.
Yeah.
Because the fish ingest that plastic and then they pass it on to other species.
And maybe some of you have heard that as plastic moves through the food chain, as plastic moves through the biological system, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and we've now found very small microplastics in even in neurological tissue. So it's getting everywhere, and it's certainly going all the way up to the food chain to even those of us who are privileged enough to sit at the top of that.
And we have industry that makes microplastics.
Yes, we also yes. So let's before we run out of time, let's get to life on land and touch on that quickly. Those folks who looked at life on land.
Yeah. I think we were most kind of stunned by the deforestation component of it, with 90% of it being due to agricultural expansion by cropland expansion and livestock grazing. I heard the first bit, but not as much about the second.
Right. So that's kind of the other side of the coin of what we talked about yesterday in terms of the global increase in protein consumption, particularly amongst nations that have had a deficit in protein in their diet. And as we're seeing more and more protein, this is the other side of that coin, right? It's more and more land dedicated to livestock raising. Yeah. The other group that was looking at life on land? Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at the same thing. More than half of that deforestation is due to cropland expansion, and less is directly related to livestock grazing.
Mm.
So, but there's no easy answers there.
So, let's talk about answers for a moment. First of all, can we all agree that compared to those of you who were here yesterday, I know not all of you were, but yesterday there was some bright points, right? We looked and we said, wow, poverty is on the decrease. Hunger is sort of plateaued right now, but health outcomes are improving around the world, particularly in the most vulnerable areas, or some of the most vulnerable areas. And so there were some real bright spots yesterday. Do y'all kind of feel so far today that there are no bright spots right now? It feels that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let me ask you the next question. Taking these four, clean water and sanitation, elimination of gases leading to climate change, protection of life below water and protection of life on land. Do we know how? Just how? Technologically. What the steps are. Forget the barriers for a moment. Do we know how to solve every one of those issues? Who thinks we do? Yeah, right? We know we can substitute things for plastic. We know we can eliminate fossil fuels. We don't need fossil fuels to power the planet. And we need time to get away from it, but we know there are any number of studies that I've read that give a perfect step-by-step roadmap from how to get from here to zero net emissions. Do we know how to clean up water? Do we know how to provide good, clean drinking water? Well, heck, we've been doing it in this country for decades, centuries. Do we know how to prevent species loss and species extinction? We actually do. People are talking about wildlife corridors. People are setting aside land for protection of wildlife. Biologists are clear, we know how to do it. It's been suggested maybe we need to set aside half of the planet for wildlife, right? And that would be, and the rest of it is ours, and right? All the other species get one half and one species gets the other half. That seems like a pretty cool deal for us, doesn't it, right? There are no technical hurdles, actually. No technical hurdles. It's all doable, let's just say that. Does everyone agree with that? This is all doable. So what then? So does that give you hope, or does that just make it worse? I'm just curious. What are your thoughts about that? Any of you? No, not. Yeah.
For me, I don't know. I don't want to say it makes it worse, but it feels like it does. Because one of the things on here too is talking about access to genetic resources, and there are some fantastic methods being used to make crops that are much more productive, so you don't have to use as much land, and so you can deal with the hunger piece. But many of those techniques and crops are owned by corporations that
don't want to give them away at a discount rate. And that's like in a capitalist society, I don't know how you like, you're just like, just give them away for cheaper.
So this is why we're following biosphere with economy, right? Do you see that? Because all of these are solvable. Solvable, but there's a couple really strong barriers, right? They deal with power and privilege and wealth and the protection of power and privilege and wealth, right? Okay. Yeah.
What distresses me is how much time do we have to do this?
In the fierce urgency of now, the speech Martin Luther made, you know what, I would love to, does anyone know that speech off the top of their head? There's a great line in which, even if we accept that we're going in the right direction in some things, there is a limit to how much time we have, right? And then clearly on some of these in particular, there are limits, right? And clearly the hour is at hand. This is the one I know best, right? This is my formal training lies here. And all of the scientific consensus says, we really need to have cut our emissions by about 50% by the end of this decade. Cut by about 50% by the end of this decade. In many countries in the developed world, we've plateaued, or actually our emissions are declining slightly. The United States, our emissions actually plateaued about 5 or 6 years ago, if memory serves correctly, and have declined slightly. But overall, right, global emissions continue to rise. We need to cut them by 50% by the end of the decade. So, yeah, we're on the clock, clearly. So, let's talk about the other sheet. How did your reading of Pope Francis' words from the encyclical Laudato Si, how did you read those differently than sort of the cold, hard statistics that we talked about before? Did anyone have a different emotional response? Does it lead you to think about different ways of talking about this with different groups of people, with your peers, with your family? What are your thoughts? Was it harder to read? Was it easier? Yeah.
We had the water and the Pope's comment about water being, was it a right for people, right? And so, and about people's dignity. So if we believe all people inherently have dignity, then they have the right to access to water. The market doesn't care.
The market doesn't care.
So I think that's where the faith leaders come in, is that we need to reinforce the message that if we're people of faith, we need to care about each other, and we need to make the market work for us and not let it run us.
Right. Or maybe I'm over-assuming about your conversation from an earlier comment, but maybe there are certain rights that should lie outside of the market, right? Maybe we shouldn't allow clean water to be privatized, right? According to your first comment. Sorry, I don't know your name. What was your name?
Bill,
right? Maybe some certain things should not be privatized because they are inherently rights of all people for their dignity, as Pope Francis says. Yeah. Other thoughts? How did you read the Pope Francis reading differently? Yeah.
Just overall, I appreciate the fact that there is a religious leader that has some heft in the world to be able to express a point of view of interconnectedness and being a piece of what God created in such a way that it may have impact on political systems, because our political system says that, speaking for this country, we have denominations and a Christian viewpoint of not having interconnectedness, but rather having dominance over. And that is still very strong in this culture, especially in the evangelical culture. So to have a leader like this to do that, I think it should have impact. But a lot of people did not study this document. Mm-hmm. I talked to my Catholic friends, and they're like, "Laudato what?"
Yeah.
Not all of them even know what it is.
Right. Jordan.
There is an effort in the Catholic Church at least I know in the United States, where dioceses are starting study groups and asking the question, what are we going to do? But I think the Catholics have the same problem that Protestants do, and that we're split.
Yeah.
But into groups where, as my initial comment in the room tonight says, that people are responding to Francis by saying, what does that have to do with religion? What does it have to do with your job? You're about spirit. This is a political economic question. Why are you involved in it?
Right.
And that's showing that there is an inherent connection, that we're still responsible for taking care of the garden is where the problem is.
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
And it says something about the fact, well, we're involved in it because Jesus was. You know, Jesus was economical, and you know, he did care about these kinds of things.
For a lot of Christians, that's a heretical statement.
I am a heretic.
Other thoughts?
Burn her.
Other thoughts besides that? She is my wife. Please don't burn her. Yes.
Well, I keep thinking this all comes down to our attitudes and expectations. Our attitudes have to do with the fact that I really don't want to live without clean water. That's an attitude. An attitude is, I've been here now for 4 days. I haven't had a bite of meat. That's new to me. Mm-hmm. And expectations, I think a big one, as I think of it, is we don't want to pay for what we want. We're not willing to pay for wooden boxes to ship things across the country anymore. And one of the hopeful things that comes to mind is the water shortage that we're hearing about to the south of where we are sitting now. And maybe the fact that Los Angeles is worried about water, they'll get more serious about changing their attitude about wanting green grass on their lawn and working with recycled water. Some people will do that. You know, every time I flush my toilet at home, I think that's some of the best water in the country, maybe in the world, and I'm flushing my toilet.
Yeah, we take something that has inherent fertilizing value and pure water, and we mix them together, and they become less than valueless. They actually have negative value, right? So two things of value mixed have negative value. Fascinating. That's a choice we've made as a society. So, if we know how to solve these, what do you think the primary barrier is? Who thinks they know what the hardest thing to overcome is going to be?
Me.
Okay, so individualism, what?
Yeah, unwillingness to establish our relationship with the other.
Okay, so individualism, yes.
Well, resistance to change.
Resistance to change, yes.
Resistance to change because it costs me money, because economics.
Money.
Money.
Scarcity.
Yes.
Scarcity.
Lack of political will.
Lack of political will.
Scarcity.
Scarcity. Perceived. Real scarcity or perceived scarcity?
Perceived scarcity.
Okay. Just, yeah. Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, the organized misinformation that, you know, the minute you start talking about lowering the carbon emissions, then the General Motors and the car manufacturers go nuts and
right.
Say, well, cars are good for the environment.
So again, power, privilege, profit, mm-hmm. and the protection of those, right? How does this fit with who we are as a church? Who's familiar with this statement? Caring for creation, show of hands? This is actually published in 1993. By the ELCA, one of our latter, about halfway through our social statements, Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice. We at the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America are deeply concerned about the environment, locally and globally, as members of this church and as members of society, even as we join the political, economic, and scientific discussion, we know care for the earth to be a profoundly spiritual matter. As Lutheran Christians, we confess that both our witness to God's goodness in creation and our acceptance of caregiving responsibility have often been weak and uncertain. I'm just going to very briefly walk through this, and I'll let you read, so I won't read it all to you. But we see that spoiling of the environment is nothing less than a degradation of God's gracious gift of creation. This is in 1993, remember, so this is 20 years ago almost, right? The urgency, twin problems, excessive consumption by industrialized nations and relentless growth of human population worldwide jeopardize efforts to achieve a sustainable future. Specifically, they call out, and I'm not listing all of the ones from, I've excerpted these from the document, but these are some ones that are particularly, they also mentioned ozone depletion, which thankfully is less of a problem now. But fascinating, in 1993, right? Scientists were all quite confident that this is something we should be deeply worried about. I think the general public was not yet deeply aware of this, but I credit the ELCA for highlighting that one. Sin in captivity, the focus on me, manifests and threats to the environment are not the last word. God addresses our predicament with gifts of forgiveness of sins, life, and salvation. So there is grace even in this. When we face today's crises, we do not despair, we act. The words of those of us who are Lutheran, anyway, those Lutherans in the room. And what I like about this is that there's a roadmap here. How do we achieve what needs to be achieved? Because what's missing, one of my favorite quotes about climate change, and I think it applies to all of these four. It was written by a photographer and for National Geographic by the name of James Balog. And I don't know if any of you ever saw the movie Chasing Ice, which was about the loss of glaciers around the world. And more recently, he did a film called The Human Element, which I highly recommend, takes a broader view and looks on the effects of climate change and pollution on humans. And he looks actually at the historical drivers of those. And one of the things that James says that I quote routinely is that we don't lack the knowledge to overcome the challenges. We don't actually lack, at least in this country, the economic capital to overcome the challenges. We don't actually even lack the policy understanding. We know how to write the policies that will accomplish the ends that we want. So we know how to do it, we know how to pay, we can pay for it, and we know even how to craft the policies to make it happen. All we lack is the political will, right? The political will. So how did the ELCA say we achieve that? And I think they give a really nice roadmap here. Justice through participation, through solidarity, through sufficiency, and through sustainability. The principle of participation is that we need to make sure that all living things are entitled to be heard and have their interests considered when decisions are made. And this is, this is particularly important to recognize that we have all of those peoples who are, first of all, the creation is inadequately represented in human decisions, but also those who are most vulnerable tend to be excluded from these conversations. And that brings us to the principle of solidarity, right? We need to stand with the victims of fire, floods, earthquakes, storms, and other natural disasters, but we also need to stand with the victims of the human-caused disasters, as we saw 2 days ago, of Bhopal, India, of Chernobyl, and the little daily, indignities, but I think that undersells it, right? I mean, it certainly threatens human dignity, but it's much more than an indignity when we export our waste to another country, be it medical waste, plastic waste, nuclear waste, or whatever. I don't think we actually export nuclear waste. But regardless, the victims of those insults to dignity, how about that, need to also be participants in these conversations. And that includes groups who are marginalized because of race, gender, economic discrimination. We could increase that list. Sufficiency is means the basic needs of all meeting the basic needs of humanity and all creation. And if those of you were here 2 days ago, right, it's meeting the needs of the current generation, protecting the needs of future generations without threatening the needs of the current generation. And nowhere in there did it say anything about maintaining this enormous divide between the haves and the have-nots. In fact, this kind of is the exact opposite of that divide. It's saying we need to be more egalitarian. Our church is telling us we need to be more egalitarian. And, you know, I kind of thought that this was a nice list here, right? Moderation, reasonableness, and prudence. And I don't know if any of you would describe American society as moderate, reasonable, or prudent.
Not a good marketing scheme.
Probably not a good marketing scheme. Exactly right. Definitely heretical. And then finally, this principle of sustainability, an acceptable quality of life for present generations without compromising that of future generations. Oh, and here we see the ELCA actually borrowing the language from the Brundtland Report. And that's very encouraging, right? Remember, the Brundtland Report came out in 1987. This is only 6 years later, and the ELCA is echoing those exact words. Recognizing the obstacles to sustainability, neither economic growth that ignores environmental costs nor conservation of nature that ignores human costs is sustainable. And here you hear the echoes of economy, environment, and society. And the intrinsic need to address all three of those. We know that a healthy economy can exist only within a healthy environment, but that it is difficult to promote both in our decisions. So, the principle of sustainability summons our church in its global work with poor to pursue sustainable development strategies. I would add also now at home in this country. It summons our church, especially amongst those who are more economically vulnerable. It summons our church to support U.S. farmers who are turning to sustainable methods and to encourage industries to produce sustainably. It summons each of us in every aspect of our lives to behave in ways that are consistent with the long-term sustainability of our planet. So, we didn't get to this, but we will tomorrow. There's another document that I do like. It was actually one of the first two social statements the ELCA put out in 1991, I want to say, which is Church and Society. And one of the things that it highlights is the importance of church being a place of deliberation and conversation. In other words, it sets forth the church as an agent of change, right? It sets forth the church of an agent, a stage at which people of multiple backgrounds, right? Our neighbors, in the Christian sense, come together to have the hard conversations and to have these kinds of conversations that can lead to change throughout our community. Because in the end, what is necessary? What needs to change to achieve those four goals, at least in this country? What was the primary barrier?
Political will.
And I know it's easy. It's easy to look at those politicians and say, oh, bought and paid for. That politician owned by the coal company. Yeah, but you know what? They're only there because someone voted for them or because someone didn't vote, right? That's the only reason they're there, because someone did vote for them or someone didn't vote. We're talking about the planet in this session, right? And we're talking about the importance of protecting the environment as part of an overall commitment to sustainability. And there's a fascinating group called the Environmental Voter Project, which I think is fascinating. And they're nonpartisan. And what they did is they did polls and found people that identified with environmental value systems. And because the polls are an open record, not what you voted, but if you voted or not, is an open record. That's public record, right? And so they were able to correlate folks who said they were environmentally minded with voting records. And it turns out that environmentalists don't vote at a higher percentage than non-environmentalists. A shocking statistic. People who are environmentalists disproportionately don't show up at the polls. And on one hand, that's important because we have elected officials who maybe wouldn't have been voted in. But there's another reason that's very important that Environmental Water Project brings forward. And that's because what motivates our politicians to make a decision, to support a policy, to ignore a policy, is pulling data from within their district. But the only thing that they care about is likely voters. And so when they look at what the opinion poll is within their district, they only care about the opinion poll amongst likely voters. They ignore non-voters. And so by showing up to the polls every single time, however small that election is, suddenly you're catapulted into a very potent force in the polling data of your district, which is, oh, I'm now a likely voter, and now my representative will listen to me more. And so on one hand, we rightly are furious at the lack of political will in Washington, D.C. or in our state houses. On the other hand, the political will is at the end, still to this day, despite the malfeasance or attempted malfeasance in our voting processes, still is derived from the people. Yes?
I'm impressed, having lived in Europe, that change in a political system usually comes from the periphery.
Mm.
Our system is set up so that if you're not in the towards the middle,
right,
you don't get the support you need. And I'm convinced a lot of people didn't vote because they don't see what voting for a liberal Democrat is going to accomplish. And the liberal Democrat may have the right values, but they know if they run on the ticket that these people would vote for, they aren't going to get the funding from the corporations they need to run a campaign.
Right, yeah. So the two-party system and also the way our primaries are structured suppress the vote in some sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thoughts, responses. We actually are at 4:30, so we're going to have to pick up economy on Friday. I'm really disappointed, but I'm really glad we had this conversation, and I hope that when we talk about economics, we realize that system change, right? If we change our policies that change our economics, then we can initiate system change. So the challenge of system change, which is so hard, right, can be achieved through economic means. And so that's the punchline of this thing. So I hope you will all come back tomorrow to talk about economics in much the same way we talked about biosphere today. But I also don't want to shut down the conversation. So those of you who want to take off dinner, I totally understand. We're at 4:30, and so go ahead and do that. But if those of you who'd like to continue the conversation, let's continue the conversation. That's great too. And I hope to see you all back here tomorrow afternoon. With that, I'll open the conversation back up. Thank you, Celia, for your input. Yeah.
I think it was something like 16 million people did not vote in 2016. And if they had, that might have completely changed the direction our country. Of course, you can't go back and say, oh, what would it have been? But still, 16 million people didn't vote.
And of course, I realize that I'm probably preaching to the choir here, right? I mean, so, right? But what's the importance of our congregations? Our congregations are actually probably, because those in the room, of course, may not be all of you, but who are mainline Protestants of one flavor or another, one of the last venues in the entire country where people of differing political ideologies can meet on shared values. And that's a really potent opportunity, right? Other thoughts? Yeah.
Well, how many people didn't vote in 2016? That's another issue.
Well, that's what she was just saying.
I think that there would have been a difference.
Yeah, it could have been.
I mean, we've got an extreme part now that's trying to turn us back to the 50s, 1850s.
Thank you. But differently than that, thinking about 2000 election for environmental things, just seems to me so tragic that Al Gore was right there and would have been such a good voice on this, and it came down to the whatever 451 votes in Florida or whatever that was. So it isn't even always 16 million.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, jumping off on your statement about the church being a place where people of mixed political persuasions still gather.
Mm-hmm.
Our church that is that, where I guess that it goes by the name of Purple Church. We are a purple church. However, we don't truly engage the issues. There's a level of niceness, in quotes, that sits there and that we have to get past.
That's always the...
No idea.
That's the challenge, right? If we want to remain Purple Church, can we have these conversations? But if we are Purple Church, then shouldn't we be having these conversations? And this is a very tricky knife edge, right, to live on.
It's
right.
not only conversations within the congregation. As you mentioned, there are a few places that I think are capable of providing a safe place for the wider community to come together and discuss.
Mm.
But we need training in how we can conduct discussions that don't result in yelling and shouting and accusations. I don't know how many of you have heard of Braver Angels.
Yes.
Yes.
But they are a group that can train a congregation on how to do that. And I think it would be a major mission of our congregations to say, we're going to discuss this issue, not to prove who's right, but ought to better understand why we think what we think and so forth.
Yeah, Braver Angels. Thank you for mentioning them. Braver Angels is an extraordinary organization with an amazing mission. If you haven't heard of them, the whole identity of Braver Angels, and I'll defer to you here, Jordan, if you want to. And also you mentioned, sorry, what was your name again?
Carol,
right. Since you're familiar with them as well. But their whole reason for being is to train people to have in groups conversations that are difficult, but in ways that are free of conflict. Is that a fair...
Well,
is
not conflict, but destructive.
Thank you. Yes.
Dehumanizing.
I'm actually about 2/3 of the way through a book. I'll bring it tomorrow if anybody wants to look at it. It's by one of the founders of Braver Angels, and it's called I Never Thought of It That Way, I think, or something like that. It's
okay.
Quite good.
Great. Thank you for that. Thanks, Carol. Other thoughts? Questions?
I think churches are afraid to allow controversy, even if it's well managed. I don't know that part, but what's more important, I fear, is maintaining or growing membership. What's happening to membership in churches these days?
Yeah.
That's the other point. What's the dynamic of young liberals that is it possible to engage them? I mean,
in the church.
Why do the current young generations say, "I don't, you're nice people, but I don't need you"?